Mr. Hagan, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
All right, you may begin.
We have four issues, and I'll stop and preface. I'm recovering from bronchitis, so I'm going to speak as best
I can. Let me save you some breath then and ask this question. Let's assume, for the purpose of my question, that this officer had no jurisdiction to do what he did, where and when he did it. The fact that there was a warrant issued by a magistrate, doesn't that cure any issue with respect to the arrest under Virginia versus Moore? I mean, we have no Fourth Amendment violation here. We have, if anything, a violation of state law with respect to the officer's jurisdiction. And there's no argument, as I understand it, that the offense didn't occur, that there wasn't probable cause for it. The only issue is whether the officer had any authority to execute an arrest where and when he did. But once the magistrate issues a warrant, why isn't all of that become, you know, academic?
Your Honor, I'm flat-footed on that issue. My focus is on the exercise of the officer's governmental authority to seize a citizen.
And that's why I say, for the purpose of my question, it's assuming he's gone. But, you know, Moore was a case where we have a statute that prohibits a police officer from making an arrest. They have to issue a summons for certain offenses, and this particular police officer did not follow that statute. And so it violated state law. But this court held that there was no exclusionary rule application to that statute, unless the statute itself provides for an exclusionary remedy. And this statute doesn't provide for an exclusionary remedy either. The case ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they agreed and said, as long as there's probable cause, we don't really care if there's a state law violation. That's the state's problem. But there's no exclusionary rule with respect to any evidence that's recovered. Why doesn't all that same rationale apply here?
Thank you, and I'm on track now.
That makes one of us. I'm not sure I understand where we are.
There was a statutory violation in Moore. And as I understood the United States Supreme Court ruling, it was that a mere statutory violation does not raise a constitutional question. So I didn't find any federal authority above the district court level, but I did find the two district court cases that I cited on the question of whether an extraterritorial arrest raises a constitutional question. I would submit that an extraterritorial arrest is in a different category from the issuance of a summons. Officers have to do a lot of paperwork. They're not focused on paperwork. They're focused on, do I have grounds to arrest, and then what do I do?
Mr. Hagan, I think if the officer in question here, for all legal purposes, was no more than a private citizen, he could have observed the offense. He could have gone to the magistrate, told them, taken an oath to tell the truth, told the magistrate, what he observed as far as your client, speeding through downtown Lexington, Virginia. And the magistrate could have issued a warrant, and he would have been tried, and there wouldn't have been an issue about jurisdiction. The only difference between that and what happened here is the officer, instead of going directly to the magistrate reporting all that, stopped him, executed, an arrest, and ultimately charged him with driving under the influence of alcohol through the issuance of a warrant. So there, I don't see. I'm at a loss to understand where there's any Fourth Amendment violation, and unless there's a Fourth Amendment violation, the fact that he had no jurisdiction, it seems to me, would be cured by the issuance of the warrant. As a separate charging document. So I'm trying to understand where you're coming from with respect to, how this case should be disposed of, because even if we went your way, it seems to me all the Commonwealth has to do is turn around and get a new warrant or directly indict your client, and he goes to trial, and we're in the same place we are right now, aren't we?
Your Honor, I haven't briefed the warrantless arrest, but there wasn't a breach of peace. I would submit that there wouldn't have been a common law citizen's right of arrest to stop and investigate
not for,
in this
not for
case.
Non-felony, that's correct.
Let me point you maybe the money lines out of Virginia versus Moore.
Yes, sir.
And again, that's talking about a violation of a state statute dealing with the validity of an arrest. And the Supreme Court said the argument might have force if the Constitution forbade Moore's arrest because we have sometimes excluded evidence obtained through unconstitutional methods. But the arrest rules that the officers violated here were those of state law alone, and we have just concluded it is not the province of the Fourth Amendment to enforce state law. That seems to me to be the answer to the question.
That is a apt statement in context. Our beginning point is that this was an extraterritorial arrest, and the Commonwealth has a very, very strong public policy in having officers respect the territorial limits of their jurisdictions.
But would you concede that the state doesn't have such interest that they included some type of exclusionary statement in the statute itself? There's nothing in the statute that says that if the arrest is conducted beyond the jurisdiction of the officer, any evidence obtained shall be excluded for trial.
There's no such language. We're asking the court to apply a due process analysis under the federal McLean and Atwell cases that we cited.
Well, due process doesn't require an exclusionary remedy.
Does not. The threshold question is, was there a constitutional violation? And that's where McLean and Atwell come in. And then it's for the court to decide under state law whether the exclusionary rule should be applied.
What's the due process violation here? I mean, he was ultimately properly charged on a warrant. And that's what he went to trial on. So where is the due process violation?
The officer in this case made a determination that he was going to do speed control at a certain location that didn't allow him to safely stop and arrest motorists within his jurisdiction. Rather than taking that good idea up the chain of command where he would have definitely been told, no, you can't deliberately exceed your jurisdiction. If you set up to run a radar station and you know that you cannot stop that motorist within your jurisdiction, either don't do it or we'll have to go to the city of Lexington and get a mutual aid agreement, which in fact happened in this case. But it's a matter of officers respecting the limits of their territorial jurisdiction.
Let me ask this question. What is the remedy here?
The remedy we're asking for is the exclusionary rule.
Okay, so it's not a question of somehow being the defendant should be acquitted of the charge. You're simply asking exclusion of the evidence obtained as a result of the search. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
But the exclusionary rule doesn't apply because it's not a Fourth Amendment. So we would have to, in effect, graft the exclusionary rule onto the state statute in order for you to prevail.
I have an intermediate step. That first the court would go through the McLean and Atwell analysis and determine whether or not the statutory violation violates constitutional due process. If it doesn't violate constitutional due process, then that's the end.
Which constitution?
The United States Constitution.
So we would be creating a federal constitution, or we would be announcing a federal constitutional violation that has never been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, it would be a case of first impression.
Well, let me rewind. And it seems you're asking for an exclusionary remedy because this police officer had no authority to act as a police officer where and when he did. It seems to me you can't have it both ways. Because if he's not a police officer, how does the Fourth Amendment apply if he's simply a citizen? The Fourth Amendment generally doesn't apply to citizens who do things that would otherwise be improper by a police officer. So if he's a police officer for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, then we've got a good search here. But if he's not a police officer, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply in the first instance. And so, I mean, I don't know how you get there from here, basically, Mr. Hagan.
If he wasn't a police officer, he wouldn't have authority to put on his blue lights to begin with.
Yeah, your position is he had no authority. Badge, gun, and all that or not, he had no authority any more than a private citizen had. And granting that proposition, it seems to me, if a private citizen had done all of this exactly as it was done here, we would have no Fourth Amendment application whatsoever.
Well, the private citizen
Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to a private citizen.
If a private citizen had activated blue emergency lights and stopped this citizen, then...
I mean, we might have
then
a state law
then the private sort. Citizen would.
We might have impersonating a police officer yeah. problem, but we wouldn't have a Fourth Amendment problem, would we?
Correct, Your Honor. And I'm up for my reserve time.
Thank you. Ms. Pierre?
May it please the court, Brittany D'Imperio for the Commonwealth. So in this case, Officer Began, the officer that ultimately pulled over Martin, acted with statutory authority when he did so.
How is that?
How is that?
Yeah. In other words, does that turn on whether he was in close pursuit or not?
Yes. So the only issue here that was raised was whether Code Section 19.2-77 was properly complied with. And case law in Virginia establishes that that code section is satisfied when the officer was attempting to arrest the suspect and was closely pursuing him. Here, the officer was attempting to arrest on page...
Well, was he fleeing?
So... Nice versus Commonwealth and Ham versus City of Norfolk says that when the officer is attempting to arrest and arrest the suspect and the officer was closely pursuing him, that's enough to satisfy
well,
it.
The problem is close pursuit is not specifically defined in the code, but as you point out, 19.2-77 uses the following language: whenever a person in custody of an officer shall escape, and that's certainly not the case here, would you agree?
Right.
Or whenever a person shall flee from an officer attempting to arrest him, and that's why I asked the question of is there a flight here, then it says such officer with or without a warrant may pursue such person anywhere in the Commonwealth, and I emphasize the word and because it's a conjunctive, when actually in close pursuit, may arrest him wherever he found. So it seems to me that that language suggests, at least arguably, that close pursuit means he is attempting to apprehend someone who has either escaped or he's indicated that the person should pull over and he's not doing it, he's fleeing. And if neither of those cases exist, and I might point out that everywhere else in the code that I could find where the phrase close pursuit is used relates to a relief from liability for a police officer who's chasing somebody, I guess it goes through traffic lights and stop signs and things of that nature, you know, with impunity and gets into an accident or something and they can't be held liable, essentially, if they're in close pursuit. So it seems to me, while the General Assembly hadn't defined it, at least where it's used in the code, it seems to me at least it contemplates a situation other than, or at least something more than, the police officer just saying, you know, I think I'm going to pull that person over when I get to a point in time when I think it might be safe for them to do so. That's a pretty subjective definition, if you ask me, isn't it?
Well, so I think, though, that, like, in Nice versus Commonwealth, the court stated that the fact that the defendant was not speeding or was not driving as to elude the officer did not mean that he wasn't fleeing the officer in that case.
Nice wasn't had the officer activated his lights and this wouldn't pull over?
Yes, he did activate his
that
lights.
That isn't the case here. So if the person hasn't been given a signal or some sort of command to pull over, then it seems to me you don't have flight, but where a signal has been given that a reasonable person should be able to see and the person doesn't pull over, then arguably the person is fleeing, are they not?
Well, what happened in this case is that Martin was speeding, going 10 miles over the speed limit. The officer flashed his lights. Martin slowed down from 35 miles per hour to 30 and then sped up again back to 35. The officer heard that, clocked him again, and then pulled out and started following him. So, and then Martin continued to drive then. Once it was safe, the officer did turn on his emergency lights and siren and pulled him over. And so I think in this case, the defendant also had notice because the officer did turn the lights on and then immediately, right after, started following him.
I don't think we're suggesting that the officer didn't have a proper motive in doing what he did here. I think if there's any fault to be found here, it's with the statute. If the General Assembly, you know, wants to provide some latitude for police officers to do what this officer did, then they need to amend the statute. But it is what it is, and it pretty clearly says if you're not in close pursuit, as however that is defined, then the arrest needs to take place on or immediately adjacent to property that's owned by the university, and that wasn't the case here. Now, a mutual aid agreement, of course, would have solved this problem at the time, and I understand from Mr. Hagan that maybe as a result of this case there's one in place now, so we won't see this again, but nonetheless, it is what it is, and you want us, I think, to expand a definition. The General Assembly arguably has chosen not to expand for whatever reason.
Okay, well, even if you find that the statute was not properly complied with, there still is no remedy under the statute, so no relief can be sought in this situation.
Am I correct that there was no challenge to the applicability of the implied consent law here? There was no challenge as it not being a lawful arrest, therefore the statute doesn't apply.
No.
This is purely a constitutional question, a Fourth Amendment constitutional question.
Well, now it is. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
At this point, it's a constitutional issue.
Was the constitutional issue raised below?
No, it was not raised below.
It was filed as a motion to suppress, but you know that's one of the things I was a little confused about as to what extent this was, you know, really a constitutional issue at all.
No. Well, first, whether or not it was a constitutional issue was never raised to the trial court. And then it still hasn't been raised currently. I haven't really heard anything that really implicates the Fourth Amendment in this case. I know that United States versus Atwell has been talked about a little bit today, but in that case, the officer observed a defendant veering in and out of a dual turn lane on a military base. The police officer decided to stop him, pulled him over, the defendant over on a parking lot which was located off of the base. He was clearly drunk and arrested him for a DUI. And there, that court, which predates Moore v. Commonwealth, found that there was no Fourth Amendment violation because the traffic stop was supported by probable cause and the officer had probable cause to arrest under the DUI statute. So here, the officer had reasonable suspicion and probable cause to stop Martin for speeding and then ultimately had probable cause to arrest him for driving under the influence.
He had probable cause, but he had no authority. So, I mean, what's your position with respect? I mean, does the Commonwealth have a position with respect to whether we decide this case based on Virginia versus Moore, or does the warrant cure any problem and we don't even need to go down that road?
I think both are valid options.
Well, thank you for that. That's my question. Which is the narrowest and best way to go, do you think?
I think this, I mean, going to the magistrate itself cured any potential defects within the statute. So I think that would probably be the most narrow way without even having to address whether or not there were Fourth Amendment issues in this case. If there's no further questions.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Hagan? Can I ask you that same question I asked Ms. Pierre? Am I correct that there's no challenge to the application of the implied consent law
here? Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
In response, I'd like to return to the question of due process because that is the up and down issue in this case. In the Moore case, the officer acted on good faith. He missed the paperwork requirement.
In the Moore case, he just ignored the statute. The statute said he had to issue a summons, and he made an arrest, a physical arrest, and you know, took him before a magistrate, got a warrant when he should have been issued a summons under state law. It was that simple. So he clearly violated state law just as you're arguing that the officer did here. Now the question though is what's the remedy for that, if any? And there may not be a remedy at all.
Well, one distinction is that in the exigent circumstances, which is cited by McLean and Atwell, when an officer is in an arrest situation where he's relying on reliable, erroneous information, no due process question. The officer is relying on reliable, erroneous information. In this case, with Moore, the officer had a misdemeanor, for Jalen misdemeanor, in his presence, and he made an arrest. He made a mistake. That was a statutory violation. But he was under exigent circumstances there on the roadside. Well, this officer knew.
You threw the word due process out. Are we talking about procedural due process here?
Due process under the Fourth Amendment as applicable
process
to Virginia.
Is 14th Amendment.
And 14th Amendment.
So, I mean, but usually we're talking about procedural due process here. And here, your client, I don't see a procedural due process issue, quite honestly, because your client, you know, was served on a properly issued warrant, ultimately issued by a magistrate. That's what he went to trial on, not any sort of defective pleading. And he was convicted on evidence that was acquired, you know, not in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So I'm at a loss to understand where any procedural due process violation might have occurred here.
Your Honor, it's a slippery slope to get into substantive due process. But in my view, due process is due process. It goes to what's right and wrong in the operation of a government. The question here is the officer knew he could not comply with his territorial jurisdiction, and he didn't run it up the chain of command. There were no exigent circumstances. He wasn't put on the spot to make a snap call. The focus here is not on whether or not my client gets off or not. It's a rule of law question, and basically all due process questions are rule of law. How important is it as a policy of the Commonwealth of Virginia that a officer not knowingly transgress his territorial jurisdiction? If this court finds that's not a constitutional question, then it's just not. But it's for you to decide.
Anything further?
That's all.
Thank you very much. No questions? Thank you very much. We'll greet counsel and call our next case, Ellis versus Commonwealth.